We are in John chapter 5, and we basically ended up about verse 43 in our last lesson, John 5 and 43 is where we ended up. So we had ended up the lesson of the Samaritan woman. We had gotten down to verse 43 where he had spent 2 days with them, which is a really a change because of the relationship between the Samaritans and the Jews wasn't very good at all. But these people, after the lady had went in and she had witnessed to them, they all came out to see for themselves, and they would declare Jesus to be the Messiah. And so all kinds of barriers were being broken down at this meeting, and Jesus going into this this village. And so we ended up at basically verse 43, and I'll read through there down through the end of the chapter. Now after 2 days he departed thence, and he went into Galilee. For Jesus himself testified that a prophet hath no honor in his own country. Then when he came into Galilee, the Galileans received him, having seen all the things that he did at Jerusalem at the feast, for they also went to the feast. So Jesus came again into Cana of Galilee, where he made the water wine, and there was a certain nobleman there who was sick, whose son was sick at Capernaum. When he heard that Jesus was come out of Judea into Galilee, he went to him and besought him that he would come down and heal his son, for he was at the point of death. Then said Jesus to him, "Except you see signs and wonders, you will not believe." The nobleman said to him, "Sir, come down, or my child die." Jesus said to him, "Go thy way, thy son liveth." And the man believed the word that Jesus had spoken to him, and he went away. And as he was now going down, his servant met him and told him, saying, "Thy son liveth." Then inquired he of them the hour when he began to amend. And they said to him, "Yesterday at the seventh hour the fever left him." So the father knew that it was at the same hour in which Jesus said to him, "Thy son liveth," and himself believed in his whole household. This is again the second miracle that Jesus did when he came out of Judea. Excuse me, into Galilee. So, in these verses here, beginning in verse 43, he spent the 2 days there. He went into Galilee. He didn't go to his hometown because he had already said that, you know, a prophet is without honor in his own country. And so, from the text, we can see that Jesus, when he came into Cana, that he was well received, that his reputation had grown at this time to the point where his presence would be welcomed, much as the Samaritans had welcomed him. And then in verse 46, this is the site of his first miracle, and the occurrence was that of, this is the site of his second miracle, and this is the healing of the nobleman's son. If we look in the New American Standard and the 1995 update, this nobleman's son is called a royal official. And in the King James and the New King James, the description is a certain nobleman. And I understand that these descriptions literally mean the king's man. And so this was a man of that had some position in the government. Josephus, in his description of these type officials, used the word an officer of the king. And so it's believed that this man was a servant of Herod Antipas. He was the Tetrarch of Galilee at this time. And but no matter, the nobleman has heard of Jesus. He's heard he's coming. So we can see how his movements were moving ahead of him before he got somewhere. He knows he's coming. He knows he's performed miracles. And he goes and seeks Jesus to heal his son. He has the belief that Jesus can do this, and because his son was approaching this untimely death. Now, there are similarities to this account in John 4, verses 43 through 54, and Matthew 18, 15 through 13, and Luke 7, verses 1 through 10. When you read different accounts of this, there are some people that think that there are differences to show that this is a separate account. Some believe that John is contradicting the synoptic gospels. But I don't know how they get that, but because the synoptic events happened in Capernaum, and which leads me to wonder why they would suspect that there was a contradiction at all. But in any event, the man showed his faith by coming personally to Jesus. It was approximately 12 miles from Capernaum to Cana, and he asked Jesus to come to Capernaum. He believed that Jesus would have to be in the presence of his son to heal him. So from these verses, we can see actually about five different things. What can we see from this short little conversation here with these men?
Jesus, or the official, knew that Jesus could heal, and he had faith that if he talked to him, he might do it, or he would.
Okay, he had some faith. He had faith that Jesus could heal his son. So really, it was probably a small faith, maybe an imperfect or incomplete faith, but he had faith that Jesus could do this because his faith moved him to seek the aid of Jesus. And another thing, to make sure that Jesus would help him or have a better chance of helping him, he came to Jesus. He didn't send any of his servants. Being a royal official, he would have had people that he could have sent and sought for Jesus to come. But he came in person himself. I think it also shows that his belief was that Jesus had to come to where his son was. And so he thought that it would be too late if his son died before Jesus came. But so his faith was incomplete. The nobleman's belief or his faith depending on the outward signs or the signs and the wonders that Jesus has performed. Now, the response here to Jesus is different from the response and welcome of the Samaritans. If we go back to verse 45, I think we can see that they welcome Jesus primarily on his ability to work miracles. I believe that was their primary reason for doing that. So, and we might think that his response to this nobleman was kind of callous when we read it. But it seems his response ignores the condition of the son. And instead, it addresses the crowd's need for some kind of showy sign. They wanted to see something. Now, in the New American Standard 77 and 95 edition, the King James Version uses "unless you people," and the American Standard, the ESV, the King James Version, it says "except you." So we have in the edition, different editions of the Bible, one says that he was addressing the crowd. One says that he was addressing the nobleman individually. And the reason I keep bringing up these different editions and things, because every time a revision or a new edition of one comes out, there's always some changes in there. And so sometimes they don't matter much. Sometimes they do. Just a little further along, I'll have an example of a pretty clear example of it. But it seems now, especially if you have a computer Bible and you have, you're always getting updates. They're always updating the version of the Bible that they have on the internet. And a lot of times they don't tell you what occurs in the update, so you have to go find it out yourself. So if you have a Bible program, check and see if it has updates. The program I have tells me when an update is done. And sometimes they tell you what they've changed, but most of the time they don't tell you. It's just an up. We have an update for this Bible, and basically that's all you get. So anyway, just a point to point out that it's getting to be fairly common where things are being revised, and so it's always helpful to know that. So what Jesus, I think, is doing in here, he's trying to get past that. His intent is to get past him being a miracle worker. He wants them to recognize him as more than a miracle worker. And I think this is important. As we, one of the things that's going on in the background here with his disciples and the crowds is he just keeps advancing and advancing and advancing. And we're going to see here in a little while, he makes a push. But anyway, he assures this nobleman that his son's going to live. The nobleman believes him. He meets his servant somewhere along the way. Some people say halfway, but somewhere along the way, he meets his servants, and he inquires that, well, what time did this occur? And the time was when Jesus did the healing, and the seventh hour. It didn't, if he had a disease, normally to recover from a fever or a disease, it takes a little while, especially a fever, you know, it's less 1 hour, or it's less, you know, 3 or 4 hours or a day, depending on what kind of disease you have. But this nobleman's son was healed immediately. And so this would further strengthen this man's belief. So the first thing he did was he believed in the power of Jesus' presence, being in the presence of him. Then he believed in the power of his word. And then he believed to the whole extent that his whole household was believed. Then this is the first instance that we have of a believing household. Now, we aren't told if this family was later baptized, but they should have known of the baptizing of John the Baptist, or they would have known that Jesus was baptized. Perhaps they were, but we aren't told that. So with this little short version of version, there's also some things that we can learn. And what are some more of the things that we learn about Jesus here that the people, his audience, and his disciples are also learning? What are some of the things? If we go back to the Samaritan woman, what did Jesus know?
He was coming for all the people, not just the Jews.
Okay, he was coming for all the people. I think one thing it shows us that Jesus had an intimate knowledge of all things. He knew all things. He knew everything. He wasn't even in the presence, but he knew about, this tells us that he knows all things. Now, this is a pretty provoking statement for us. Sometimes I don't think we realize that, well, yes, Jesus knows all about us, all about our intimate details. And just as Jesus showed that he knew, he had knowledge of all things. And that's a pretty provoking statement. Should be a pretty sobering statement for us. By knowing that, that will help us in our walk with Christ to stay on that narrow trail. He knew the extent of the disease. He probably knew what the disease was. He knew where the child was. And he had the power to heal him, even though he wasn't in the presence of this child. So this I think is the first healing from a distance. In other words, he wasn't even there, but the healing occurred. And so this shows that supernatural power of Christ. It shows that if Jesus can heal this disease, he can heal the disease of sin. I think that's one of the important things. And now we see also the benevolence of Jesus. He is always ready to heal or to save. So I think that's some of the things that we can learn from these these few verses. So, and it was said, this is the second miracle that he did in Galilee. Any comments before we go on to chapter 5? It's a pretty interesting group of verses, a long chapter actually, as is chapter 5. And so, nothing else. We'll pick up there in chapter 5, and I'll read a few of those verses to get us started. After this, there was a feast of the Jews, and Jesus went up to Jerusalem. Now, there is at Jerusalem by the sheep market a pool, which is called in the Hebrew tongue Bethesda, having five porches. In these lay a great multitude of impotent folk, blind, halt, withered, waiting for the moving of the water. For an angel went down at a certain season into the pool, and he troubled the water. Whosoever then was first after the troubling of the water stepped in, was made whole of whatever disease he had. And a certain man was there which had an infirmity of 38 years. When Jesus saw him lie, and he knew that he had been now a long time in that case, he said to him, "Wilt thou be made whole?" The impotent man answered him, "Sir, I have no man, when the water's troubled, to put me in the pool. But while I am coming, another steps down before me." And Jesus said to him, "Rise, take up thy bed, and walk." And immediately the man was made whole. He took up his bed and walked. And on the same day was the Sabbath. The Jews therefore said to him that was cured, "It is the Sabbath day. It is not lawful for thee to carry thy bed." And he answered them, "He that made me whole, the same said to me, 'Take up thy bed and walk.'" And then they asked him, "What man is it that said to you, 'Take up your bed and walk'?" And he that was healed did not know who it was, for Jesus had conveyed himself away, a multitude being in that place. So here we have the instance of another healing. Jesus is going to be there. He's going to be present. There's a large group of people around him. It says a multitude. Who knows what a multitude is? It's more than a crowd, I would think. But anyway, they are in a space that is probably full, if I had to guess. Because you can read accounts of this. There's umpteen accounts about the sheep gate, the pool of the, and once you get through going all through all of these, you get the idea that it's mostly speculative what they're saying about this place that Jesus is at here. Now, so he's returning to Jerusalem for a feast, and here again, there's a lot of disagreement on what feast it was. A lot of speculation. And not that it matters. We do know that all males had to come to Jerusalem for the Passover. The two other feasts that all males had to appear in Jerusalem that were required to attend was the Feast of Tabernacles and the Feast of Pentecost. And so it was likely one of these. Probably, if I had to say, I would say it was probably the Passover. But there's not a lot of agreement on that either. Because you can spend a lot of time reading different authors of their opinion of which feast this was, but it really just tells us that Jesus is coming back to Jerusalem. Now, there's going to be some danger in him coming back to Jerusalem. He's not very well liked there by the Jews. Now, when John uses the word "the Jews" or "Jews," he is referring to the leadership. He's referring to the scribes, the Pharisees, the Sanhedrin, and the people that the priests and so on. So anytime you see the Jews in John's writing, he is primarily speaking of the leaders of the Jewish people. And so the sheep gate is supposed to be the gate that they brought the sheep and the oxen in for sacrifice. It was also near the temple. It was near this pool of Bethesda. And there were porches there that sheltered the ill and infirm and the halt and the lame. And we're, as we read, there was a lot of people there, a multitude of people there. So the healing miracle that occurs here was different from all the other miracles that occurred in the Bible. If we take it that getting in the water cured you and an angel did it, we can see that it wasn't just one miracle, but it was a continuation of miracles whenever this water was disturbed. And there's a whole lot of thought given to how this water was disturbed. Some say it wasn't an angel, it was two springs that came together there. Lots of stuff like that. Anyway, it only occurred when the water was stirred up. And only to one person at a time, the first person that could get into the water. Now, everything points to this being a supernatural cure, and which could be attested to by people who were still alive when the Apostle John was alive. So it was attested to because people and John were still alive. Now, there's just an awful lot written about this pool and this gate, and even down to where it's thought to be. Nobody knows for sure today, but where it's thought to be. Probably if you were to go over there and take a tour, they would say here is where the pool of Bethesda was, and perhaps they're right, but they come down to even its size, how many feet, and, you know, it was more than a pond, but a small lake. I mean, you just find all kinds of descriptions, people trying to describe this place where this miracle took place. But I think a lot of it is really just speculation because there's just a lot that they don't know. Now, it was said that an angel stirred the water, but this angel, nobody had ever seen this angel do this, but it was claimed to be, or judged by the Jews to be, an angel because of the effect that it accomplished. There were actual healings. Now, some argue that just not the first individual to get in the water was healed, but the first ones who were in the water were healed. Now, here again, the different versions have different accounts of this. Some say the first one, some say the first ones. If you go to the King James, the American Standard 77 and 95, they all say the first one. If you've ever read the People's New Testament, even it says the first one. Now, if you, the English Standard Version reads, "And while I am going down, another steps down before me." Now, interestingly enough, if you have a English Standard Version, there is no verse 4. I mean, you're reading along, verse 3, and the next verse is verse 5. So, and I think I have the latest updated version of that Bible. But anyway, it's interesting that it leaves that verse out completely. And there's different thoughts on about this verse, about this angel stirring up the water. Some say it's a fable. Some say it's a superstitious belief that the Jewish officials allowed this concession because it was a popular belief. Well, it may have been just a popular belief. It may have just been a fable, but this man believed it, and he was at the pool. And so, fortunately for him, that he was there. But anyway, it's really interesting when you're reading along, and all of a sudden it goes from verse 3 to verse 5. Now, there is the one I have, there is a footnote in there. So, and basically it explains why they think this shouldn't be in the Bible, in the English Standard Version Bible. But the English Standard Version is the only one that has that, that I could find. So It's really interesting. Jesus' reply to this man was immediate. Get up and walk. I would imagine this probably surprised the guy. But anyway, he got up and he walked. He had been an invalid for 38 years. So, you know, there wasn't really any need for an immediate healing. Jesus could have waited till after the Sabbath. But Jesus didn't wait till after the Sabbath. He was there on the Sabbath day, and he healed this man on the Sabbath, apparently to show that he was the ruler of the Sabbath. And this is where Jesus begins to really challenge the Jewish leaders. This is kind of really an in-your-face statement, you know. So he's starting to push harder, and he'll be pushing harder. There are some Jews there who are going to protest this. They're going to be a dispute about it being unlawful. This individual was told that he had broken the Sabbath. Now, when you broke the Sabbath to the scribes and the Pharisees, it was a serious thing to them. This wasn't a minor thing. You know, it wasn't like missing church one Sunday. This was serious, really serious. And so they would have had the man leave his bed or stay there and watch it, not pick up his bed and go. The Jews wanted to know who told him to do this. And the man didn't even know it was Jesus. He just knew he was healed. He was ordered to take up his bed. And he was actually ordered to violate the Sabbath, which I would have probably done the same thing if I'd been 38 years with not in this condition. I would have probably got up and carried my burden on the Sabbath too. But when we talk about the Sabbath day, we're talking about Exodus 28 and 10, Nehemiah 13 and 15, and Jeremiah 17 and 21. That's where carrying burdens on the Sabbath was forbidden. Now, one of the things that we can learn from this is that, what can we learn from this?
Jesus is the Lord of the Sabbath.
Jesus is the Lord of the Sabbath. So he had the right to declare what could be done on the Sabbath. He had the right to declare a change, even to dispense with a portion of the law. To that extent, Matthew chapter 12, verse 8, and John chapter 5 and 17 both declare that Jesus is superior to the law. And so this is an example of that, that Jesus is superior to the law. And so this is how Jesus is beginning to show the Jews what is really permitted, and that the laws of necessary and mercy were lawful. If the man had left his bedding, it would have probably been stolen or lost. It wouldn't have been there probably when he got back. Now, one thing that's interesting to me is in verse 12, the Jews or the rulers, they didn't ask him who made him whole. They asked him, who told you to break the Sabbath and take up your bedding? So, apparently, this man was so happy and relieved that he was no longer invalid that he didn't even ask who it was.
To me, as I read the Bible in general, and I can't really point to a verse, but, you know, it seems like God intended us not to plan to work on the Sabbath day.
Right.
Not us, I mean the Jew.
Right.
So I don't plan on fixing my roof on the Sabbath. But if a wind came up and took away my roof and I did some emergency thing to protect my family from the elements, that was apart from that. In other words, if your ox is in danger of losing its life because it fell in a precarious place, you could pull it out. But don't plan on shoeing your horse or whatever they did back in those days on the Sabbath.
Right.
So this man, this was an extraordinary event. And to me, that was not the intent of the Sabbath, to preclude the extraordinary.
There's always a place for mercy. There's always a place for mercy. And so I think that's a good point. But here is something that, was instantaneous healing. Now, some of us have diseases, and it takes a long time to get over them. But this would have been something that would have been the most remarkable thing in the world to this man and to those who were at this place, at this pool. But I think Jesus actually just removed himself because of the situation where they were. I've read one account that said this. You had to go down a whole bunch of steps even to get to this pool. Some said it was 150 feet down to this pool. So I don't know if that's right or not, but people have done a lot more studying on it than I have. That's what they say. I've always thought that it would have been just kind of maybe a step or two and you walked in it. But anyway, this was something I think he didn't want to excite the crowd. And he, because of the conditions there. Yeah, go ahead.
Also, my thinking on a great multitude of sick folks waited for this movie in the water, and they thought it was an angel, and the first one, or do you say maybe the first few that got in it, would be healed. You know, there's people who think things like that today. Right. You know, there's a lot of sites in Catholicism where Our Lady of Guadalupe and things like that, where they still think if you're there when this apparition appears,
right,
you'll get healed. I think this was one of those things. I don't think if John is saying this is what happens. I think he's saying this is why people were there. This is what they believe.
And it was. And I've read that the Jewish leaders permitted this, but that the culture of that day, there were a lot of these pagan shrines around. And they compared this to maybe one of these pagan shrines. And so it was permitted. But I think, like Ed says, this is something that... something that was going on during those days. But anyway, verse 14 reads almost as if Jesus went looking for the man in the temple to me. Now, that may not be right, but one of the reasons the man, and I don't know if he went immediately to the temple or it was later the day, the next day, or whatever, but anyway, Jesus found this man in the temple. Now, it could very well be that the man went there to make sacrifices for his healing. So that's to offer sacrifices. And so if he would have went to the temple to offer sacrifices, then he would have believed that this was a work of God. And so at least he didn't forget God, and he didn't neglect to thank him for the healing. And it was in the temple that the man learned that it was Jesus who healed him. And so Jesus offers the man some good advice. He says, sin no more, lest something worse befalls you. And what could worse could befall you? But we can learn a few things from this. At this time, people thought if you were halt, invalid, lame, something like that, or had a disease, it was because of sin. But Jesus knew his past life, apparently, how he ended up in this position. And perhaps indicating that his former sins were the cause of this. He shows him that he has knowledge of his past sins, and he shows him with this statement that he has knowledge of the future, and that if he continues in sin, something worse is going to happen to him. Now, if you've been laying around 38 years with this problem, what else could be worse that can happen to you, you know? Well, Jesus is talking about the resurrection or the judgment day. Well, we're out of time. You have a comment before we go on? Okay, Lord willing, we'll pick up there next Lord's Day.